This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got...
Hello everyone, this is Clint Locklear for Trapping Across America. I'm sitting in the Predator Control Group lure shop, and I may get a little iffy. We've been, me and Travis have been, we looked on the shelf the other day and we had one coyote gland lure left. So bottles came in day before yesterday and the odor of coyote gland is intoxicating to the point of cheap perfume in here. And I can't go over to the house because they're doing construction on it right now. And if I go outside, the ducks are going to be squawking. So I'm in here, so if I start getting a little tipsy towards the end, just know what it is. It's not Jim Beam. It's Coyote Buttholes. It's doing it to me. And it is loud in here because 20 gallons of Glen Lure that's been made, that's going into bottles and stuff like that, it is overwhelming. So I'm just giving you a heads up before we start on that. We've got kind of a show, just like normal, it's going to go all over the place. It's going to go to a hopeful story, historical story, a sad story, technical story, a cool story, and a maybe story. So we're going to try to get through all this today to get this. And the first thing I want to talk about, the hopeful story, is apparently Illinois, I don't know how, there's not nothing I could do about it in time, but Neil Graves sent out, which is the president of the Illinois Trappers Association, sent out mass emails, and apparently I'm on one of the lists, and guys in the state could fill out a form and stuff and talk about bobcats and seeing them and this, that, and the other. Apparently they've got a law going through the Senate, which would have been 3 days ago or 2 days ago, that was possibly going to give them the ability to trap bobcats in the state of Illinois, or at least in part of it, which is a very good thing because Southern Illinois has quite a few bobcats. And it's a shame not to do any type of management on those. And eventually, the way the cats seem to be moving across the country, they're going to be up even into the farm country of Northern Illinois before it's over with. And part of the stuff that's over by the bluffs and everything, I've always wondered why there's not more cats over there. And eventually, I'm sure there will be, because the bobcats in the last couple of years, from talking to different people, they seem to be spreading out more across the country. And I'm not sure why that is, but it's a good thing for trappers. You know, Illinois being a half communist state anyway, they're probably not going to, they're going to have them on a very short leash. But for guys that want to go out and catch a bobcat, that's a pretty important thing. And so hopefully keep your fingers crossed. And if there's anything that I can help, if I think it's too late by the time I've got this to do the show, but if there's anything that I can do, or maybe the Trapping Radio audience can do for Illinois on getting the bobcat bill passed, I think it would be a good thing. And from what I could tell from the emails that came through on this list, that the politicians aren't against it. So that's always a good thing right there. Now, the sad story, guys, that I want to talk about, and some of the younger guys aren't going to know who he is, really, but all the older guys are definitely going to know who he is, especially if you go to a convention. Carol Black from Blackie's Blend Lure passed away. And I've got the obituary. It says Carol Black, 74, Nashville. He lived in Ohio, in case you didn't know. And Carol Black, a 74, Nashville, passed away Monday, March 23rd, 2015, at the Life Care Hospice. After extended illness, funeral services will be March 28th. At 2 p.m. at Alexander Funeral Home, Millersburg, with Pastor Tom Harley. So if you're in that area, guys, it would probably mean a lot to the wife and everything to go by and just say hello. Friends may call Saturday from noon to 2 prior to the services at the funeral home. Those wishing to share a memory or make online condolences may visit I think it's F is in Foxtrot, H is in Hilo, I is in India, N is in November, and C is in Charlie.com. So it's AlexanderThat.com. Family suggests memorial contributions to be made to the Nashville Fire Department, which is P.O. Box 418, Nashville 44661, or Ohio State Trapping Association's P.O. Box 322, Clyde, Ohio 43410. So they're asking if you know Blackie and stuff like that, and you wanted to help out some way. They're not asking for anything for themselves, they're asking you to donate to the local fire department, which was important to Blackie, or the Ohio State Trapping Associations was definitely important to Blackie. He was born on October 7, 1940 in Mount Vernon. Son of Everett and Millard Black, married Joanne in 1980. She's still around. She's an awesome woman if you've never met her. Carol worked at the Pittsburgh Plate Glass in Mount Vernon for 13 years, 10 years in Airflex and Wooster, formerly known as, oh boy, I'm not even trying to pronounce that one. And he was owner of Blackie's Blend. Trapping was his passion. When Carol was a small boy, he came fascinated with his uncle's Fur Fishing Game magazine, sparking his interest in trapping. He began Blackie's Blend and formulated lures, produced his own line of trapping lures and baits for 34 years. They became nationally recognized, being sold to the trapping public, plus dealers' distribution across the country. He attended state and national trapping conventions to sell his product and get his catalogs out there. He was even given trapping lessons and went on trapping excursions to New York, Indiana, Arizona, Wyoming, and California. His business and his wife's pride and joy. He was a member of both the Ohio State Trapper Association and the NTA. There's some more in this. You can, if you wanted to see it all, you could just Google Care Black, 74, Nashville. Family would like a heartfelt thank you for the doctors and nurses at the Wooster County Hospital and entire staff at Life Care Hospice for all the care and support they gave to Carol. Now, Carol was a good friend of mine. Blackie was an amazing man. And cancer got the best of him. And it's somebody that we're all going to miss if you've ever been with him at a convention or someone to talk to on the phone. He's always good for a smile. But more than that, what made Blackie so special to me was not that he made killer lures or that he had very high quality products or he could talk to you about trapping or anything else. Blackie was an intellectual. And if you didn't know Blackie very well and you just saw him at conventions and you talked to him about lure and trapping, you may not have realized that. I've been over at his house. I've been out to dinner with him several times. And at the conventions, and he gave when I say he was an intellectual, he was a thinker and he studied people. He really got involved with different things and he took it to great detail and he loved trapping and he liked being around trappers. So, I mean, just a really cool guy. The first time that I went to Blackie's shop, I pulled up, you know, clean cut yard, everything was nice house. Went in, talked, sat on the couch, and I'm looking around and I'm seeing pictures of Elvis. Now, I'm not exactly an Elvis fan. I remember going to Graceland when I was little. I remember the Cadillac and the house was white. And at the time, I was thinking the dude had no taste because there's shag carpet on the ceiling, all kind of weird stuff. So I'm not exactly an Elvis follower by any stretch. But when I talked to Blackie, which was so interesting, he really liked Elvis, but he was into following Elvis impersonators. And I know that is a crazy, off-topic type thing to do, but he knew who they were. He would go see them in Vegas. He was really into weightlifting. When he was 68 years old, I mean, he was still benching 245, 265, something like that out in the shop. Big barrel-chested man, if you've never seen him. But one of the coolest things, I'll never forget, I went to his shop the first time, and it was immaculate. I mean, immaculate. And you can tell where his original shop was and where they've added on for extra space over the years. So you had kind of his pouring room and he had bottles and stuff on shelves in there and he had a big table and, you know, you'd see the grinders and all that type stuff. But over in the corner was a humongous powerlifting weight set. And I don't mean, you know, some little wimpy plastic thing. I'm talking great big steel plates and lots of them. And me playing, you know, football when I was younger and stuff like that, we got to talking about that. And I found out he was really into bodybuilding, really looked up to Arnold Schwarzenegger and Franco Colombo and all these older guys that I haven't heard the names of in years. And we got talking about that, and we'd talk a little bit about Lure, and then we'd go outside, and he had this great big German Rottweiler that he spoke to in German to get it to do what he wanted to do. And I'm talking big. Whatever Blackie did, he didn't do anything halfway. And the neat thing about Blackie is when you would talk to him about this, he would know the history, he would know the different aspects, he would know the goods, the bads, what worked, what didn't, how he could relate to that and different things. And it was just so fascinating to talk to him. He wasn't, and you know, some people have been surprised, and I can tell by the emails, when I'm at the point that I'm at now in trapping, and I say, if you can figure out how to make a second income or a living outside of trapping to go trapping for fun, they've been kind of surprised at that. Well, Blackie always had his lure business, but he was always multidimensional in what he was looking at and studying. If you talked about rubber boots for coon trapping, he could talk to you about every rubber boot on the market. What was in the rubber? What was the length? How were they in cold weather, warm weather? Where were they being made at? Are they different now than they were 10 years ago? I mean, he studied it and studied it. And when it came to his vehicles, he treated his vehicles like he was going into Afghanistan after the Taliban. I mean, the way he did his maintenance and his tires, and he would soup up the suspension and have special air cleaners on them. Everything was dialed in to the utmost degree, which was part of what made Blackie so unique when it came to his trapping. I think a person that has different aspects of their life besides trapping is a better trapper, because it puts things in perspective. It keeps you from getting burnout. It keeps you from, it lets you look forward to something instead of it being all encumbersome in your life all the time. And one of the coolest things about Blackie, and I've been doing this, and I got this idea from Blackie, and as y'all probably know, I listen to a lot of different podcasts on motivational stuff and business stuff and different things like that, and I hear quotes. And when I hear a quote that really resonates with me, I take Blackie's lead on it. If you come into my lure shed, you'll see these little poster board things up all along the walls. And this is what Blackie did. He would take his quotes, what could be from Hemingway, they could be from Arnold Schwarzenegger, they could be from Elvis, they could be from Einstein, they could be from anything. So in his work area, when he's doing lures, consciously or subconsciously, he's seeing these phrases all the time, and they're getting burned into his brain. And to me, that was just really cool. Now, our personalities are very different. His would look like it come off of a machine at a printing place, and mine look like what they are, which is poster board and a black marker. And I'm in here in the shop, and I'm just looking at some of these things, and it just lets you know what some of them are. Is like I'm looking at one that says, can I make a living at that? Which I hear trappers all the time say. And it says, well, do you know how to make a living? With a question mark. Three most destructive traits of American people today. Drugs. What's it? I really need to get my glasses. Drugs, carbs, and salaries. The three most destructive things to Americans today. All progress comes from outside of your comfort zone. Never become good at anything you hate to do. Different things like that. I've got these all over the shop. Travis comes in here, and I don't even know if he pays attention to them anymore. But as I'm walking around, I'm seeing this stuff that keeps me focused on what's important to me. You know, all progress comes from outside your comfort zone. Well, if you see that every day, and I'm sure Blackie did it for the same way, or at least that's how I took it. When he read those quotes, it just keeps you where you don't fall into mediocrity, because you're seeing things all the time. And that's one thing that he really struck me at. Now, if you didn't know Blackie, he's got a Coon book out. It's still on the market. It's a really good book. I wish, back when he wrote that book, books were not to the detail that they are today. I really wish that he would have put everything in that book that he went over when we did our interview a couple of years ago. And you can search that on Google, I'm sure. Carol Black, Blackie's Blend, Trapping Radio. It's a fascinating, fascinating show. And if you listen to it, I promise you'll be entertained. Because one thing that me and Blackie always really clicked on is when we went to trapping and we were trying to catch stuff really, really fast, we're like two mercenaries or soldiers, the way we looked at the vehicle, the tires, the canoe. He would pad his canoe. He would go as far as camouflaging the lid to his lure box, so if it was open and someone just happened to look across the creek, something shiny wouldn't catch their attention. He would never float down the middle of the creeks, because people across the bridge would notice that, where if he saw a car coming, he could slide over to the bank and not move. And most people, being the way they are, they never even see him there. Never put in at a regular canoe. He didn't want anybody to know or when or where he was trapping. He had his canoe set up to the point where it was like a battleship when he went out. Everything was in place. It was soundproof. It was camouflaged. His wife would have a pickup point depending on where his line was at. I mean, it was like reading an operations order from when I was in the military. I mean, Blackie was a cool dude when it came to that. But he was also a cool dude when it came outside of trapping. And if you don't know who he is and you hadn't listened to that interview, I really suggest you go back and do it. Because it's, with Blackie being gone, there's never going to be another Blackie. And if you've never been to one of his demos, you really missed out something in life. So that's part of the reason I think going to conventions are so important, is you get to meet and learn and see what people are really like. We were at West Virginia a couple of years ago, and he gave a demo, and he started out talking about, and I think I've got a video of this, talking about gland lures and call lures and things like that from Bill Nelson, which he looked up to. And then he went into knives and boots and all kind of stuff, and you know, got all over the place, because that's who Blackie was. And then at the end, he started telling these stories of overcoming and doing things that people don't think you could do. Let me tell you, West Virginia Appalachian males are not the most sensitive type of people as far as wearing their emotions on their sleeve. And some of the examples he was talking about was Mark Twain, Einstein, and Elvis. And the history of them, well, he didn't tell you his name at the beginning, but the history of them, why they should have never been able to do what they were doing. Einstein was considered a dumb kid at school. Elvis couldn't hardly move. Mark Twain was just considered an idiot. And they become the greatness because they kept striving and striving and striving. And when he got done, he related that back to trapping. And there were several, I'm talking dozens of guys in the audience, because it was so powerful the way he did his, that there were tears in trappers' eyes at a trapper convention at a trapper's demo. That's how powerful of a person that Blackie was. And it was really Blackie. It wasn't a show. That's what was so neat about him. And I know I'm going to miss him. And if you want to give him a call or a postcard, I'm sure they'd appreciate it. If you want to donate to the two places that they said, the fire department, Ohio State, they would appreciate it. But trapping lost an icon, as far as I'm concerned, this month. And it's a shame. Now, I'm going to go to something different, because I've got to get completely off that topic, because it's kind of bothering me. But I want to do a little bit of history. And I want to put this back towards trapping. This is from Dennis Murphy. He sends me some of the coolest stuff, off the wall stuff on email, airborne beavers and all kind of things. The Mighty American Fur Company adopts the latest in transportation technology to its businesses, dispatching the company's new steamboat, the Yellowstone, to pick up furs in Montana. Now, this isn't like the 1820 guys. A decade later, John Jacob Astor had formed the Western Department of American Fur Company to begin exploration of fur trade in the western reaches of the continent. In 1828, Astor established a large trading post called Fort Union at the strategically important point where the Yellowstone River merged with the Missouri, located near what would later be Montana-North Dakota state line. Fort Union allowed Astor to dominate the fur trade of the Northern Plains and Rockies. With ruthless efficiency, Astor's American Fur Company steadily undercut and eliminated its competitors. The company had the financial resources to invest in competitive adventures that smaller companies like the Rocky Mountain Fur Company could not afford. Far from beyond a rustic backwoods operation, Astor's company is one of the most modern and progressive corporations of its day. In 1830, Astor saw an opportunity to use new technology to further consolidate his stranglehold over the Western fur trade, the steamboat. The paddlewheel steamboat New Orleans had begun regular service in the lower Missouri only 18 years earlier. During the 1820s, steamboats occasionally ventured as far north as Missouri as Council Bluffs. Now the American Fur Company boldly proposed to extend regular steam service all the way up to Fort Union Trading Post at the mouth of the Yellowstone. The company hired a Louisville shipyard to build a boat specially designed for the treacherous currents of the Missouri, christened it the Yellowstone. It was a sturdy craft with large cargo deck to carry fur and trade goods. It had a high wheelhouse from which the pilot could see and avoid many of the snags and shoals of the Missouri. Departing from St. Louis on the day of 1832, the Yellowstone reached Fort Union in June. Let's see. I didn't take them very long. When the craft attracted the marveling admiration of Anglo traders and Indians alike. Therefore, the Yellowstone and a fleet of seemingly designed steamboats regularly traveled to Fort Union where the water levels were not too low or the rivers were not frozen. While the American Fur Company modernized with steamboats, its less affluent competitors continued to rely on small man-powered keelboats to move the fur trades and their goods. By the mid-1830s, boats like the Yellowstone had helped Astor eliminate less fur companies, and the American Fur Company enjoyed a virtual monopoly over the far western fur trade. Now, why would I read that to you? Well, guys, I see this all the time in trapping. And if you're my age or older, I'm probably talking to you more than I am a younger person. For some reason, trappers want to hold on to the old ways, whatever that means to them, because if you're my age or even 70, there's really no old ways because you're still pretty young in the scheme of things. Technology is not bad. Technology can allow you to do things better, quicker, and more efficiently than you ever could before. Like when you hear how Joey Van Dyke's using GPS to mark his sets, mark his routes, he's got all of that data sitting there, so if he wants to go back to an area, he knows where all the otter crossovers and toilets already are at, and different things like that. Now, there's a learning curve to using technology like that. And it's really, really easy for a trapper to go, you know, screw that, I'm going to do it the way I've always done it, and this, that, and the other. And what happens to you, hands down, almost every time, is you stay at the same level or catches or efficiency that you've always been at. Technology can be such a huge, you know, technology is not good or bad. It can be good or it can be bad. It can be used for good or it can be used for bad. It's up to the particular person to use that. The internet's a great thing to learn about trapping. The internet's also a great thing to get you in trouble, because you can learn bad things, or you can get involved in things you shouldn't be involved in, or you become part of the I hate everybody that's not me club. You can use it to grow your business, or it can be used to destroy your business. Technology by itself isn't really good or bad. But the guys that look at technology, look at the future, look at what's out there, and they keep an open mind about how to use certain technologies in certain areas, something simple as a portable pocket, or something that used to be old that's been redone to where it works better than what everybody does now. The disposable stake is considered new technology. But there was, I think it was Brookshire, had a version of that back in the 80s or late 70s. It just never really caught on. And if you go back further into history, you will find that people were taking mower sickle blades, like off of a hayer, and making disposable stakes as far back as the 40s and 50s. So, it's, you know, we look at that now like it's new technology, and it's not. And there's a lot of guys that, for whatever reason, because either they don't trust it, they don't see it, and technology is always going to make you question what you believe, you don't try it. And if you try the technology that we consider something as simple as a disposable stakes, you've got Brookshires, you've got the Wolfangs like I use, from the Freedom Brand Wolfangs. Those things are getting better and better. That technology is getting better and better and better. The old easy stakes like you see in some of the older fur fishing game videos that Tom Miranda's were using, try that crap around here. They ain't going in. I've tried them. I can drive a Freedom Brand Wolfstang through a railroad bed and hold a coyote. Technology's got better. But at the same time, if you're still stuck into using rebar, you've got weight issues, you've got energy issues, you've got double staking issues, you've got to pull them, you've got to do all that, and it slows you down. And there's still people that's wanting to fight that technology. Now, there may be a reason why somebody out there rebar's better. I don't know. But is it because they dislike doing it the way they've always done? And if they are, they're going to be caught, they're going to be in this little bitty rut their whole life. Using something like Google Maps to scout out a line before you physically put rubber on the road to go look at it, that's technology that every trapper should be using. If you're not, you're missing the boat. Because you can only see from a vehicle what you can see from a vehicle. If me and you're scouting the same place, I'm going to know where the side ponds are for the otter. I'm going to see the flow of the land better, and I'm going to see how animals are going to go from ridge to ridge or cross roads or around neighborhoods and stuff like that. I'm going to be able to see all that from Google, which is free, which is not hard to learn, that some people are just intimidated by the fact of using technology. A steamboat, we look at that now, and that's like old school. Why would you even do it? Back then, that was space age. And for a trapping company, which was considered... This is one of the phrases that caught my attention here more than anything, because as in most times in history, most people looked at trappers as this knuckle-dragging, toothless Nathaniels that went around and didn't think and were just like cavemen. But when it talks about this particular company, it was the most modern and progressive corporation of its day, and it was a trapper based industry based at that time. And there's still a lot of that going on today. It's just not mainstream, just like fur was not mainstream back then, to the point where you want to think about it when you read those old mountain man books. But they used technology. They saw something out there that they could translate over to trapping and give them an advantage in the field. They're buying fur, but it could be a trapper trapping, or it could be a fur buyer today doing it. I don't know.
I have a feeling there's going to be in the next 15, 20 years down the road, because our industry is always about 10 years behind the rest of the world when it comes to using technology, that fur buyers are going to be able to buy online. And there's probably going to be a whole lot more of end user fur buyers from China and Russia and Greece that are going to be buying, not from NAFA and not from North American Fur Auction, but they're going to be cruising trappers' websites to buy their lots directly. See, that's technology that would be advantageous to the trapper to do. That would be technology that if somebody out there was wanted to go down that route, and don't call me to do it because I've got way too many irons in the fire as it is, but if a trapper were to actually do a fur co-op or a fur ground root something fur thing, and then get in contact with the buyers and stuff of China and these different places like that, you could completely cut out all the middlemen between the trapper and the end user or the buyer or the coat maker. And you could do all that online using technology with very little money. The end user will have a better idea of what's out on the market. The trapper will be able to get more money, because it's kind of like if somebody out there wants to go down this route, I'll definitely support you any way I can. But if I had somewhere that I say I had 50 cats from Tennessee, I could take a digital picture of those cats with their length, their width. They could see the bellies. They could see the spots. Come up with some way using a ruler with a digital picture to fold the fur up so you could see the length of the fur on the back, the sides, and the belly. The fur end user would know exactly what he's buying. They could cruise through all the cats. If they need high grade, they buy high grade. The end user has the option then not to sell or to sell. It could be a bidding thing online, just like eBay, with using technology. It could be better than that. It could then, the fur buyers, the end users could have a Yelp system set up, which if you don't know what that is, it's like an Angie's List, where if a trapper is a dirtbag and tries to screw over the fur buyer, they can rate the trappers on their quality of fur. The trappers could rate the end users on if their money's bad or good, or they pick it up, or they want to play games, or they're always trying to cut you down, or they're always playing whatever. You could Yelp those each other out, so the seller and the buyer know exactly who they're dealing with. They know exactly what they're buying, and there's no middlemen. And what would something as simple as that technology do? What would that mean to the trapper? Well, I haven't looked at corn in a while. Last time I looked at corn prices is about $2.52 a bushel. Let's say it's $5 a bushel. Farmers are happy at $5 a bushel. $5 for 56 pounds of corn. Well, they sell to a middleman that sells to a commodity that sells to a middleman and this, that, and the other. And it ends up on your shelf as something as easy as Doritos corn. Now, the Doritos that you buy at the thing are like 3 ounces for $3. And I don't know what that me. Get my calculator out, and I'll show you why using technology from the fur end would be such a big deal. Okay. Let's see. There's 16 ounces divided by 3 equals, okay, times 56 equals times $3 equals. Okay. Here's the difference of if trappers would get out of the way that we've just always done it. And fur buyers can do the same thing. That's what's so cool about technology, is everything will be more open, more concise. I think from the trapper all the way to the coat manufacturer would be happier. and everybody would make more money because there wouldn't be so much gamble. So and I'm going to use corn as an example because everybody understands corn. 56 pounds of corn selling for a whopping $5 a bushel, which is 56 pounds. Or the end user is selling that to your wife when she goes in and gets a bag of Doritos. The farmer sold it for $5 a bushel. I think Pepsi Company owns Doritos. They're selling corn at $895.99 a bushel. So they're making $890 on a bushel, and a farmer's making $5. Now, there's packaging, and there's processing, and there's all that type stuff in between there. But what's happening to the farmer, just like the trappers guys, is you've got all these middlemen, and it's treated like a commodity that's faceless. Because when a farmer puts number two dent corn in a silo in Nebraska, it gets mixed in with a number two corn silo in Iowa, which gets mixed with a number two corn silo in Alabama, and it's just a thing. The farmer has no way to grow better corn, sweeter corn, less pulpy corn, different varieties of corn. It's just number two dent corn. But if the individual farmers, say a farmer could grow a sweeter version of sweet corn by using different things, and I'm not going to go into gardening and permaculture on this, but just to use a point, because this is the way trappers could do it. If he could grow a better version of corn through cross-pollination to make Doritos better, he could then go to Doritos and sell those directly to Doritos or whoever that the beginning of their processing is, because they would have a better product. He could sell that for a whole lot more than $5 for 56 pounds, and he would make better use of it. And I think using technologies, and all this is just off the top of my head, guys, but if you use technologies to buy and sell fur between the trapper and the end user, or the trapper and the tanner, or trapper and a fur buyer, and that way you could, everybody would be on the same page and everybody get exactly what they want, you would have more control over all from the buying and the selling all the way across the board. And use another technology like Yelp, where you know if you want to deal with that person or not, or if the fur buyer wants to deal with you. Because if you're somebody that tries to hide damage and sneak in crappy fur with good fur and stuff like that, they will know what they're dealing with, and you're not going to make as much money. So it's up to you, and it's a true form of capitalism at that point. If you've got character and you've got a good product, it's worth more money because they know they can trust it and they know what they're going to get. If you're a shady character that has so-so product that's always trying to get over, they're not going to bid as much on your stuff. And then you as the trapper will have to make your mind up. Either I need to be accept the lower price or have better quality stuff. But everybody would come out that way, way ahead using technologies like that. Just like the GPS for knowing where your traps are at if you need to do that. Using Google Earth to be able to scout something. Technology isn't bad. Using, to me, and this is going to, someone out there is probably going to get all upset and think that I'm turning green or something, which anybody that would say that to me just needs to get their head out of the fourth point of contact. Tesla makes a car right now that is a technology that trappers can't afford to trap out of. But like all technology, it comes down. It is a fully electronic car. It's got way more gadgets and gadgets and stuff like that than a trapper would ever want. And it's like $100,000, so you're not going to go out and beat that up down a dirt road. But think about, it's got a 300-mile drive radius. 300-mile. It can go 0 to 60 in 3.9 seconds. And with a computer upgrade, it can go 0 to 60 in 3.3 seconds. So power's not an issue. I mean, that's like Ferrari speeds there, and it's a car. Well, if you because it's electronic and it's a motor, just like I've got a golf cart that I use in my garden and stuff like that to carry around trees and potting soil and things like that, or I can if I need to go run over and get another 36 Freedom Brand dog proof traps or drags or portable pockets, I can just get in the golf cart, zip over to where they're at on my property, put them on my golf cart, and zip back. The cost for me of that golf cart was like $1,200. It runs off batteries. Somewhere down the line, I'm going to have to replace the batteries. Our electricity here in Tennessee is really, really cheap. So I can't even tell when I plug the thing up as far as monthly rate goes. So it's like free. But I'm using that technology to save time if I need to go do something for my wife or get something for trapping or for gardening or go feed the ducks or the chickens or whatever I'm doing. I hop in that technology, which is kind of strange on 2 acres to do that. But it saves me a ton of time over a day's time. I can get more stuff done. Now, what if trappers could figure out a way or talk with somebody like Tesla or another company, because these are going to get more common, regardless of what your views are on peak oil and all that type stuff. Take all that off the table. From a technology point of view, at $2 a gallon of gas, which is cheap nowadays, $10 a gallon of gas, I'm running 150 miles in some type of vehicle, and we'll say that we get 20 miles per gallon. That's 7.5 gallons. That's $14 a day. We're going to run a trap line, 14 times 120 days, $1,600. Well, I can tell you that ain't right, because I spend way more than fuel on that. I'm doing something wrong with a calculator. But you take up your, unless you're running more than 300 miles a day, what are your gas receipts over the year for your particular vehicle? Now, what if you had a vehicle, because the price is going to come down and a trapper could use that technology, where besides plugging it in at night, you can go check your traps for dang near free? Now, what is that going to do to the profit level of your trapping at that point, using technology? Well, I can tell you, fur could be worth less money and the trapper could make more income if he didn't have fuel cost. Everybody understands that and makes that, but it's a technology. The trappers, I guarantee you, if somebody came out with a $40,000 full-size truck or something the size of a Toyota or an F-150 or something like that, that could go 300 miles on that, there'd be a lot of trappers that would fight that because it's not manly. Now you're what are you turning into, PETA? Are you turning into the EPA, you know, wannabes or whatever? And you'll let the dichotomy of what an outdoorsman, quote, is supposed to be get in the way of what it really should be. I can tell you, when I go to Texas, I don't know how an electronic car would get me down there. But even if I had to pull it with a regular car, I know in Texas, out of my Jeep, when I was running the school, I would spend right around $120 every 2 days. So that's $60 a day, every day for a month and a half. So that's 45 days. 45. That's $2,700 once I got down there. And that's not counting 1,000 miles there and back. $2,700 is a pretty good chunk of chain. That's only 6 weeks out of the trapping season. I would love for there to be an electric car. I would love if they could figure out how to put solar panels on that thing in Texas. I never have to plug it up down there. May not work so good in Cleveland, Ohio, or Maine, where you got clouds. If somebody out there using a technology that is so new, guys, this technology is so new that it was used in the 1600s by the Catholic Church And a lot of the farmers and stuff at that time is called Trump. T-R-U-M-P. Look it up on Google. It's compressed air using water out of a creek that allows you to run a car for 3 and 4 hours off of air. It also allows you to run a... it's very old, simple technology. But it also allows you to run a walk-in cooler for free. You can air condition your home for free. You can make your own electricity for free. Trump, look it up. If you want to get a good explanation of it, Google Bill Mollison, Trump permaculture, and he'll explain this technology to you. There's people around the world that still use this technology. We just don't use it here. I mean, how cool would it be if you had a creek using a system like this? It'd probably cost about $3,000 to put in, at least around here with our rock. That for the next 20 years, you could go trapping for free. Technology. That's not really technology. That's like medieval stuff. But it still works. If you could figure out how to do that on some type of scale, even on four-wheelers and stuff like that for trappers, huge benefit to the trappers. Don't be afraid of technology when it comes to this stuff. That's all I'm going to say about that. But if you catch yourself just automatically bristling up because somebody mentions using technology and trapping, ask if it's going to help you or hurt you, not that it's new to you, because there's a huge difference from that. Okay, one cool thing before we get into a trapping, a really cool set that someone told me about on email. You know, when I was talking about the dog food thing, I had a guy, he's a trapper, he's a truck driver, and he called me yesterday and he was asking some questions. And he goes, you know that idea you had on the dog food and that guy from Minnesota that's really going through with it? And I'm like, yeah. He goes, well, you know, I think it was his sister or sister-in-law has a dog that's diabetic. And you know what the veterinarian told the owner of that dog? If we feed the dog way more venison, a lot of the diabetic in the dog will go away. So look at, you feed an animal corn and wheat that's not supposed to eat corn and wheat, it's going to screw its system up, become diabetic. How many, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of dogs across the country, or millions for that matter, are taking insulin because they're diabetic from commercial dog food? To me, that's just kind of one of those, that's really cool. That's using something that trappers could take advantage of to have more money from the products that they sell. So I know the guy in Minnesota listens to the show every week. That's something to add on your resume of why it's important to do that. Because that's really cool. Now, an email that I got 2 weeks ago, I guess. It was an email, and it was one of these, why don't you talk about this on your show? Because I think it often gets overlooked. And he's absolutely right. We're going to talk about it pretty quickly but intensely. And then he talked about a set that he uses, and I may not have exactly how he's using this set down, but I emailed him back and I said, I'll definitely talk about the other subject, but do you mind if I talk about your sets you're using? And he said, go ahead. Because if someone tells me a set that they're using, they don't want me to talk about it, I ain't talking about it. Because it's their thing. But he didn't seem to care, so it's a really cool idea. But the first topic he brought up to me about trapping that I think a lot of people overlook is he's looking at becoming a full-time trapper. At the same time, he got really sick this winter. That made the reality of becoming a full-time trapper, where it's money-based and that's your only income, put it in a lot different format in his brain than he did daydreaming about it in the future. Because he still has house payments, I'm sure, maybe car payments, kids going to college, electric bill, cell phone, internet, yada, 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 all the normal stuff to live. If he got really sick and he probably couldn't trap. Well, if that was his only form of income, his point was, what do you do as a professional trapper? And the second part of that is trappers need to take care of themselves a little bit better so they don't get in that situation to begin with. And he's absolutely right on both accounts. Guys, I don't want to say what I'm getting ready to say where someone thinks it is cool or motivating or anything like that. For all those years that I trapped full time for strictly income and I didn't have lures and DVDs and all that stuff going on, when you were sick, you still had to trap because there was no way that you had income coming in because, you know, your house payment and those bills show up every 30 days. I mean, it's amazing how that works. And the more you need the money, the shorter that 30 days seems to become. So you're scrambling all the time. So you get sick, you got to work through it. Now you get sick enough, there's nothing you can do about it. And then what are you going to do? You're going to have to start either living off credit or you're going to start going into foreclosures and stuff like that. And that ain't a good place to be. And trapping should never, never be in a situation to cause you pain. It should be a good thing, not a bad thing. But I can tell you now, 46 years old, I pay the price every day for what I did for all those years. Now, from a movie point of view, that sounds pretty cool. From a real life point of view, it's not very cool. I've trapped where I've actually had to cut the britches out of my pants, where I think at the time I may have had a case of Girardia, I don't know, where I was crapping all day long but still trapping. So I'm setting traps with my fanny hanging out so I can just lean over and take a dump wherever I'm at on the trap line because there was no way to go anywhere else. Dude, that ain't fun. Any stretch of the imagination. I've trapped with a broke thumb. I've trapped with dislocated shoulders. I've trapped with broken ribs. I've had to get cortisone shots in both of my elbows to make it through seasons to do some of the catches and have the stories that I talk about today. That ain't counting just all the flus and colds and throwing ups and all that other type stuff that comes with it. I've had it with twisted ankles. I've had to wear braces on one of my knee where I've twisted it beaver trapping before. All that type stuff. And the reason I'm telling you that, not that Clint's a tough SOB or something. I didn't have a choice at the time. You do things that you don't want to do when you need to do them or you have to do them because money is what makes the world go round as far as having a house and everything else. Part of the problem with doing that is you get older, you definitely pay for that. I aches, pains, different things like that that still come up on me today because of that, I'm going to be dealing with that for the next, well, as long as I live. So that ain't cool. I mean, you know, you hear about the guys that do rodeo and they get all beat up and they take some 20 minutes to get out of bed. When you hear a story like that, you're off and on that story in 30 seconds. Oh, that sucks. But look what he did. Look how cool. Look what he sacrificed, yada, yada, yada. There has to be life outside of trapping. And you don't want to beat up your body so bad that you can't do anything else once you go past that prime time of being able to do it. And the other thing he brought up is, I think it was teeth problems that he had. You know, just simple things. And when I go back to some of my prepping roots, survivalist prepping, whatever you want to call it, you know, one of the things that you get pretty clear the more research you do on that, if you've got teeth problems, you get them fixed. If you're not taking care of your teeth to begin with and you're worried about some scenario happen, you need to take care of your teeth so you don't get in a situation if that scenario happens. So something as simple as brushing your teeth all of a sudden can become something of a prepper survivalist reason to do that. The same with your health. What you eat, if you stay in shape, if you do different things like that. One of the one of the biggest lessons for me personally in my overall life that I learned from Blackie is I was starting to get back problems. And I've never been a small guy, ever. I weighed 265 pounds when I was a junior in high school or a senior. When I was in the Army, the lowest I could get through starvation, all that crap was going on through, was about 230 pounds. My weight, up until about the last 4 or 5 years, have never been an issue as far as joints and stuff like that. But it is. It is now. I mean, it's not too bad now, but I can see in another 10 years it's going to be bad. Well, if I'd have had more discipline on some of that other stuff in my life, it would have made the trapping so much easier and so much better. Somewhere down the road, I'm going to twist something or do something like that. It's going to knock me out of a full season. Between the old injuries and the weight and everything else. So taking care of yourself is a good thing. But I was having these back problems, and I'm not a doctor, so don't do this on my thing. But I know a lot of trappers that have back problems. I haven't had back problems in about 7 years at all. And what Blackie told me when we got to talking one time about weightlifting, one of the reasons he did weightlifting is to keep in shape, but to keep everything working right. And I found that interesting. I got to talking with him. He goes, if people with back problems, unless they have nerve problems or something like that, most people won't have back problems if they have a strong back. So if they deadlift, which is not a sexy thing to do, if a person deadlifts, they build a stronger back, everything gets held where it's supposed to be held, and very few people have back problems. Well, I thought about that for 3 or 4 months. I'll pull up my weight set, and every week, no matter what's going on in my life, I have about a 30-minute session of deadlifting. I'll warm up, I go up to about, because all the weight I've got goes up to about 350 pounds. I deadlift that final set for 3 reps, I do a couple more lighter sets to calm back down afterwards, and I go about my business. It takes me about 30 minutes. That little thing of discipline that I've done since Blackie led me onto that has completely stopped my back issues. It also keeps me from getting tired as easy if I don't do that during trapping season, because you're up and down. You're falling over banks and climbing up the sides of creeks and getting out of the vehicles and all that type stuff. Your back being such an important part of your physique as far as structurally being in place made a huge difference to me. So that's something that I could do to take care of myself, and I still do to this day, that has been amazing in the results. I may not lift weights of any kind besides that at all for 6-8 months at a time. But that deadlift, because I know what it does for me, I'm going to keep doing it. If you're having like one of the things I've noticed for me personally, and when I talk to other people that get outside of the realm of I'm a man and I do this anyway, if you eat breakfast when you're trapping and it's protein based, you don't really get hungry till later in the day. And the easy thing for trappers to do is get a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or some ham sandwiches or like in Texas, tortillas and stuff like that, and you eat that and it's got a lot of carb base, it spikes your blood sugar about 2 o'clock, you just want to go take a nap. If you're disciplined, you'll muscle through it and you'll keep going about your business, but it's just not comfortable by any stretch of the imagination. Now, something as simple as understanding that certain carbs on certain people spike their blood sugar, and when that crashes, you don't feel good, don't eat it to begin with. It seems like that could make common sense, but it's easier just to make sandwiches and deal with the fatigue every day. That's one of the things you can do. And I do believe as trappers, if you're going to be in this thing for the long haul, you do have to start thinking more about your health than most people do, or at least I did. You know, it's going to be different. than all your guys, your buddies that eat or drink or behave a certain way. You will be a little bit different from that. There's no doubt about that. That's a little unnerving sometimes. But if you want to be in this thing the long haul, you got to be here for the long haul. Blackie was benching over 250 pounds at almost or at 70 years old. He was a strong man to the end. He could physically do things that most 20-year-olds couldn't do because he took care of himself. It was important to him. Made a big difference. So, you know, I'm not going to spend too much time on this, guys. But if you want to be in this thing for the long haul and you don't want to get sore and have aches and pains and stuff, you know, it sounds really cool to hear about someone trapping with broke bones and dislocated joints. But it ain't fun 10 years down the road, I promise you that. I'd rather have not done that then so I can feel better now. Just saying. Now, this guy also had this set. Now, this is really cool. I don't know weight-wise how practical it is for some guys, depending on the vehicle and different things. And I think practicality has a lot to do with how many sets someone's getting out in a day. It could be a part-time thing. It could be a before and school after thing. It could be before and after work. But the system this guy uses, it's just freaking genius. It really is genius. It's simplified putting in a predator set to the nth degree. Now here's what he's doing. This is the way that I picture in my mind, and I may be wrong, but this is what I'm picturing in my mind from the email. And the more I thought about this over the week, the more it's intrigued me. And it's intrigued me in some different ways, which is kind of what turns me on, thinking about, you know, better, faster, easier ways to trap so you don't have to beat the living snot out of yourself all the time. Imagine a trap. We're going to say it's a number 3 Bridger Douglas. 10 foot of chain or cable. I would use chain just for the kinking issues. Hooked to maybe a 3 foot piece of hardwood that's cut, that's fresh. Or either that, or it's been not rotted, or just something you pick up out of the woods, but something that, you know, could be seasoned, you know, like hickory is what we have a lot of around here. I could definitely see that, or white oak or something like that. You got, say, 3 foot of this, and it's probably about 6-8 inches round. So it's going to be fairly heavy. And it's going to be big enough that it's not going to go anywhere very easily because it's going to get tangled up real quick. So that's kind of your drag. Now, there's nothing new about that. So you got a wood drag that's a good size. It's 3 feet long per se, 8 inches round. You got your trap attached to it. You could use an eyelet. You could cinch it down. You could notch it out. You could do whatever you wanted to do. But here's the reason I thought it was such a cool idea. He's drilling a hole in this drag. Or 2 holes, or 3 holes, or whatever you wanted to do in the drag itself. So I want you to picture what making a set like this would be like. You get out of the truck, you're going down a farm. Early fall, you're feeling chipper. First day of season, second day of season, you got all this energy. You're wanting to get as much stuff out as you can. You know, you got about 5-6 days for the rain's going to come in and kick you in the nuts anyway. So you're trying to get out as much equipment as you can to get a big bump on your catch to, you know, get everything going in the right direction. What do most guys do at a trap set? They get a bag, they get a shovel. Like me, I've got an auger before the portable pockets. You get out, you dig a hole, you beat a stake in, you lure and bait it, you bed your trap, you go through all that. There's a lot going on there, guys. You start digging holes, you're using energy. You start beating stakes, you're using energy. If the ground's hard, you're using energy. If it's going to rain, you're going to get in trouble. And we've talked about this over and over again. But what if you could reach in the back of your truck? Now, see, you got a partner. Yeah, that's what we'll do. We'll put the competitive American male syndrome on this. You're with a partner. You pull up to your first location. Say you got a field that funnels down. The trees and everything are funneling towards you. You got game trails coming off. You got droppings in the road. You're feeling fresh and frisky. You want to get all these traps out. You and your buddy are jawjacking each other, making wagers on who's going to catch what. Everything's going good. He gets out on his side of the truck. You get out on your side of the truck. He grabs a shovel. He starts acting like a construction worker. He digs a hole. If he's coyote trapping, he knows anything about coyote trapping, he's digging a real hole. He's taking rebar or disposable stakes. He's beating those in like he's a construction worker. He's burning that energy. He's this, that, and the other. He gets his trap in there, gets his lure, puts it down in his hole. Way most people trap. Now you, we'll say you're the one that's going to have the upper leg in this to make you feel better. So you reach over in the back of your truck and all these logs back there your friend's been making fun of you about. You grab one of those logs that's got a chain wrapped around it with a trap already attached. You step off the side of the road and you see some grass sitting right there that's kind of a focal point, and you nestle that log into that grass. You kick the chain behind the drag and you just rip up some leaves and grass and throw over the chain for 2 or 3 feet. The chain comes back under that log or around the edge. You just dig a trap bed. That's the only construction work you're doing, is digging a trap bed. You bed the trap in. You've got 2 or 3 holes drilled into your piece of wood, which once you put lure in there, you might be able to go 2 or 3 different sets before you ever got to worry about putting more in. It's going to soak into the wood. So in one of those holes, you take something like Federales and you smear down that hole. In the other hole, you're going to put Boss Dog. In the other hole, you're going to put a booty call cow gland or something. You got 3 smells, which is going back to the George Good way of probably one of the best flat setters in America back in the 60s and 70s. You got 3 different eye appeals. You didn't act like a construction worker. You really don't care if it rains as long as you got your traps not down in a hole and you got material over it that can handle some rain. So all you did was lay down the log, kick back the chain, do your trap bed, put your lure in the holes, sift over your trap. Now this is what would happen in the real world. The real world, the guy that's digging the hole is still digging and beating. The guy that's using the log, because he didn't have to act like a construction worker, he's got his set in and turns around, puts his bag back in the back of the truck. He's probably going to walk over to the other side of the truck and lean up against that truck while his buddy's over there acting like a construction worker, seeing how fast he can burn through his breakfast. And the other guy's hitting rocks and logs and roots under the ground, and he's digging, and then his stake driver gets caught up in between 2 rocks and this, that, and the other. And you, because you use this other system, because you're thinking ahead of the average bear, you lean up against the truck and you kind of grin. And the guy's going to notice you over there because your set probably took a realistic 1.5-2 minutes to put in, because really all you did was bed a trap. That's all you did. And he's over there beating himself to death. And then you're just going to be leaning back against that truck and you're going to be grinning. And he's going to notice that you're leaning against the truck and that you're grinning. And he's going to want to know, well, how come you're not putting your set in? Oh, my set's in. I just like watching my buddy work. You know how that's guys are. You know exactly that's how guys are. You go to the next set. All you're doing is grabbing that log, unwrapping the chain, bedding a trap. That's it. Put lure in the holes. You're leaning against the truck. And after about 10 or 15 sets, you're going to be ragging the living snot out of your guy that's over there. By now, he's done got his jacket off. He's down to a t-shirt. He's fussing because the ground's too muddy or it's too dry. There's rocks, there's roots. there's this, that, and the other. And by the time the next morning comes, you realize, since you've got a lot of time to stand around, maybe, just so my buddy don't feel bad and I can actually make him feel worse, every time we get out of the truck, I may put in two sets to his one set. So when we go back to run traps after you, the smarter guy that's figured out a different system, you're checking 2-1. Laws of average are always going to be in your favor. So who do you think is going to have more fur? The guy that's checking 50 traps or the guy that's checking 100 traps? That's what this system meant to me when he kind of explained it on the email. That is cooler than snot. Is there going to be some refinements made to that? Are you going to have to figure out how the coyotes are going to work it? Or the fox are going to work it? Or are the coyotes going to, you know, try to kick it back? Or you're going to have to go through that learning curve with any system whatsoever. But once you get that system down, now no one's going to want to go carry around 100 logs to do this. But realistically, that's about the only system I know that an average trapper on an average day with average weather and average dirt is going to be able to put out 100 sets. It's going to be something like that, and it's going to be more dependent on his influence of getting from one set to the other than it is actually putting the set in. Because that is freaking fast. And it's low energy. And it's low maintenance on your body because you're not going through all the motions of everything else. And it's going to catch coons, and it's going to catch cats, and it's going to get caught. I mean, think about it for cats. You want to get a cat's attention? No problem. You've got the logs at home. Why don't you drill 3 or 4 holes coming from the top with a smaller drill bit? You got your turkey feathers, or your frou-frou feathers, or stuffed animals, or dinosaurs, whatever you want to use to get a cat's attention. And all you've got to do is put those in the holes. Put in 3 feathers, you got something that's going to get a cat's attention and a coon's attention and a gray fox attention better. Now, let's even have more fun with this situation. A week later, one guy's running 50 traps, other guy's running 100 traps, and he's grinning from ear to ear because his other buddy's just getting aggravated to no end because he's getting his butt kicked from catch to catch because you're trapping the same locations. But you're running twice as many traps. Now, after that 5-6 days or whatever it is, the big rain comes. The guy that's using the log is going to be grinning when they go run those traps because his buddies is going to be washed out from the dirt hole. His didn't make any difference. None whatsoever. Rain is, if you drill them straight into the side of that log and you know where they're at and you set them on that angle, you get a little bit of water in the hole, it's not going to make any difference. But you're not going to be washed out. So on those days, guess who's still catching and the buddy's not catching? The guy that's kind of used a little bit different system. I think it's slicker than snot myself. Will there be a learning curve with it? Oh, yeah. How animals use that, depending on where you have it, how far away from the travel way, the type of block in, how they're going to come into it using the wind. All that's going to have to be learned. But that's the easy part once you get the system down. Once you get that system down, guys, you're rocking and rolling. Just think about how fast that is. Drop a log, kick the chain back, bet a trap. Next set, drop the log, kick the chain back, bet a trap. You could pre-bait these things at home, I guess. It may get messy if you're bouncing them around and lured stuff's coming out of your holes. I personally probably wouldn't do that unless I could plug it with cotton or electrical tape or something like that and just rip it off. But it's so fast. I mean, getting that extra 5 seconds when you're saving that much time, is it really worth the aggravation of lure getting knocked out when you hit a bump? Probably not. That guy used his brain. He needed an attractor, he needed a way to secure the coyote, and he needed a way to do it portably. Now the logs that size are going to be heavy. No question about that one. But think of how fast now, let's take this even further, guys. let's take this one even further. Using a system like that, one that you can come up with yourself or whatever, but just thinking about when you use something out of the box like that. Now you and your buddy are going to pull sets. Let's say he's still into the rebars. What do you have to do to pull a set that's got a trap and a chain and a log? Pick the log up, wrap the chain around it, set it in the back of the truck. How much energy did you just burn? How long does it take you to do that? And the cool thing about a set like this is you're taking your lure and bait with you. So you're not having your pet bait and lure there for 7 months while everything goes around and gets used to it. You're doing something that the old wolfers used to talk about being extremely important that very few people will do anymore, is when you leave, your attractant goes with you, and that counts odor. Wolfers never left that stuff sitting there because they knew if they come back, they it would not be as effective because the animals have been able to be around that smell over and over and over and over again, and it's not going to have the same type of enticement. So you're pulling, you're setting the traps easier, you're pulling the traps easier, you're running more traps with it. You're not having to deal with the weather issues as much. You can modify something as simple as that to put feathers on for cats or whatever. Very simple, just a few seconds with a drill bit. It's genius. I think it's genius. And I think if trappers want to become actually better all the time, that's the type of stuff you need to start looking at. I mean, what clicked in the guy's brain to do that? I have no idea. But something somewhere, I guarantee you, it was labor related. Labor's pain. No one likes pain. Simplicity. Dealing with drowned out dirt holes. Maybe, I don't know, not having luck with standard flat sets. I don't know what it is. But that's cooler than snot. You could have some that are charred. You could have some that are not charred. You could play around with maybe painting some of them to see if that makes a difference. For bobcats to fox to coyotes to coon. You could have it where maybe instead of have it being flat the way that I'm pictured it. So if you've got a trail, it's perpendicular or parallel to the trail. So if you got a 3 foot log, it's 3 feet up next to the trail and your trap's in front of it. Maybe you switch it around. You have better luck if just the end's pointing towards the travel way. And you can zero them in a little bit better. Or if you're around a lot of cats and you've got a lot of down feathers and stuff like that, and it's real easy to scoop up a bunch of leaves and pine straw and grass clippings real quick, you can make a cache set out of that really quick. 5 seconds. Change the total look of it in 5 seconds. That's cool. I mean, that's really cool if you think about it. Now, the big question is, if maybe for some reason you don't want to go about that system, that's fine. What can you do on your own trap line to get more efficiency out of that but still have the productivity? Because I guarantee you that set, that sun gun's going to be rocking and rolling. Be just as good doing that as smearing on a grass clump or putting a stick in the ground or putting a mouse hole in the ground or anything. It's going to work just as efficiently as that. Genius. So when you're out trapping, are you doing the same thing that you've always done to get the same results that you're always going to get? Or are you going to start expanding your mind a little bit and going, maybe I don't need to do that. Or maybe if I did this, I could get a better result. And I can tell you from a fat guy, I'm always trying to find an easier way to get the same productivity. Because I enjoy the part about trapping where I got to figure out what the animals are doing and the trap placement and how they're going to work the set and the wind and the way the land's flowing and all that type. That's what turns me on. Not digging holes. That doesn't turn me on. If it did, I'd go get a job as a ditch digger. That other stuff, and that allows me on a system like that, or a portable pocket, or all these other different type things where you have like almost like the fake M44s and different things like that, that allows the trapper to be more of a trapper and less of a construction worker. And no matter what one trapper says to the other, I guarantee you, if there was a way to get in their little brain, the trapper that does less physical work to catch the same amount of fur is going to be happier than the guy that's got to work himself to death to catch that same amount of fur. So when you're thinking about your trap line, and you're thinking about going out doing preseason, and you're thinking about your sets and different things like that, think outside the box, guys. Because the box is contained. It's just this little bitty thing. It's a box. Think of it like a flat rate postal box. The whole world is outside that box. And you don't know if something works till you try it. But you don't know to try it if you don't think about it. So start thinking. Because I guarantee you, and every single person listens to this radio show, you've got a little ingenious devil sitting on your shoulder right now trying to thunk you in the head with a baseball bat going, listen to me. Listen to me. We can do this easier and better. You need to listen to that little guy. He's your friend. That's not being lazy. That's being smart. Yep. I'm going to close on this one, guys. And I hope y'all have a good week. And I will see y'all next week.